Hours Don't Make an Ideology, a podcast about the 69th best show of the 21st century. I am one of your hosts, Ian, here as always with...
Ryan Swen, hello.
And Ryan, I'm so glad that we're meeting on this momentous day. The fates intervened, and we are recording on the day... the release of Bloor Street, out now, on cooking vinyl, lead single Bloor Street. It's an exciting time for guys who love Bruce Springsteen being played by former alcoholics in bars in Ontario.
Each time I see the cooking vinyl part, I haven't bothered to look into it, but I can't tell if it's like... that's the label name, or if it's actually on vinyl, or maybe both.
I think it's both. it's sort of weird because Kiefer, along with a friend of his whose name escapes me, Jude something, I think, they actually had a record label for a while. I think it was called Ironworks or something like that, and I don't know why that's defunct anymore. They released a record, or maybe even multiple records, by the like sort of adult contemporary slash rock band Lifehouse. So I don't know why Kiefer is on this this other thing now. I honestly at first I thought it was just like the distributor or like but it does seem to be like a distributor label type situation.
Right.
On Apple Music, the album is listed as country. But it is bar rock. It's not, I wouldn't say, like, it maybe has a little bit of country inflection in the way that I think like all bar rock does, but it's like, yeah, if your dad was in a cover band and he started writing original songs, like, this is probably what it would sound like. We'll have a full review at some point.
Yes.
Because I'm feeling a little bit melancholy that now this bit is coming to an end. I don't know what I'm gonna do now.
The question, his last album was what, 2019? And so presumably it was delayed at least a little bit because of the pandemic. So, you know, there's definitely a good chance that he will release at least one or two albums within the run of this series, provided that the series does not go even longer than we're expecting. But first I have to comment, it seems that now, in a move similar to artists that we were discussing before, Kiefer is simply going by Kiefer. The album cover has his name in huge letters at the bottom right, just Kiefer, and then he's standing in front of a rushing past old subway train that has Bloor Street on it, or maybe cable car or tram or something like that. I think to whet the listener's appetite, I'll read out the blurb on...
Oh yes, please do.
On his website. This is Kiefer Sutherland's website. The Bloor Street album presents a rich variety of sounds. Two-stepping in time, ups the tempo as Kiefer steps boldly into heartland rock territory to tell a story of a love that changes everything. A theme which he extends with both So Full of Love and Chasing the Rain. There are bigger surprises elsewhere, with a surprisingly tender County Jail Gate telling the tale of a lifelong criminal who can't stay out of prison, while the brighter production of Goodbye struts with a swaggering Stax R&B groove. Kiefer brings a curtain down on the album with Down the Line, a touching duet which brings heartache and hope in equal measure. also, this is Kiefer speaking about the Bloor Street single. They say you can never go home. This song, for me, says in your heart you can never leave.
That's, you know what? And that's kind of lovely. I will say I have not listened to the whole album yet, but I don't know if it's just my complete ironization, but I kind of like Bloor Street the song. Like,
I've only listened to half the song, as is the case with Two Step Me in Time, but it's got a nice feel to it, like a nice sort of like sunny but also kind of melancholy feel to it.
Yeah, it's very... I feel a spiritual connection to it as someone who spent some time living on one of the Great Lakes. Like, there is, you know, it's sort of like an ode to Toronto, to his childhood home, you know, and he hasn't lived there for a long time, and
right.
You know, it's not anything brilliant, but like, you know, the arrangement's nice, and his voice, which is like, you know, perfectly serviceable, it's like it works on that song. And the county jail gate one too is like very is sort of interesting. I think it, one of the things I posted on Twitter at some point, he sort of, you know, it's a little bit about his own experiences. Mm-hmm. You know, he struggled with alcohol and stuff like that, and ended up in jail at one point. And mm-hmm. But the song itself has, I mean, I think I described it to you as like a guy who loves Bruce Springsteen, you know. Like, it definitely has, brings some Springsteen stuff. Some of the other stuff is just bad. Like, there's like a bluesy number I heard that's just god awful. But, you know, it's like, he's not, he's just a guy who likes to play music as like another thing that he does. And, I can't help but respect that, you know, he's doing that. Like, no one is scrambling for this album.
Yes.
But, like, good on him. Like, go do your thing, make your music. And the little fireside videos he did are actually pretty nice. He has a nice touch on the acoustic guitar, especially. I wish it wasn't quite so produced in some ways. Because I think that, like, the amateurness of his voice actually sounds better when it's not filtered through, like, production.
Yeah, apparently it's produced by, you know, like notable like country producers for Carrie Underwood and things like that. So, I mean, I've like, he's definitely going for that sort of thing, but like there's, you know, like he's also trying to stretch himself, which is a interesting contrast. In the Blur Street video, I'm always amused by seeing like that home movie footage of Donald Sutherland.
Yeah. It's great. It's got a nice vibe. Yeah.
Yeah. And also we do have to note in the at least one of the home acoustic recordings, he says that it is currently farkin freezing in Los Angeles. So he's in front of a fireplace. I don't know exactly which day it was, but I'm pretty sure there were a lot colder days before, but you know, maybe the time of day or something like that, or I assume that he was like up in the hills somewhere, but could be wrong.
Yeah, how cold has it been there?
I mean, you know, you're in a much different place, but like it's, you know, the
well, you know, it's always relative, right?
Yeah, the lowest it goes is like high 40s.
But that's 50s. That's rough when you don't, like, I'm assuming most people don't have heat.
Yeah, I guess
like
it depends.
Kiefer probably does, but
oh, Kiefer definitely does. I mean, I actually in my dorm I do have a heater.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it's definitely nice, but you know, that is a good point. It's also like always that sort of, you know, LA New York dichotomy. New York people generally don't have air conditioners, stuff like that.
I don't know how they do that one.
Yeah, I don't know. The quote about the Blur Street single actually seems pretty apropos for Jack Bauer and his sort of ongoing travails and relationship with LA. There was actually something that we didn't comment on last episode where there's a brief moment where Tony speaks to Jamie in Spanish.
Yeah.
And it's just like thrown there without subtitles, which I liked, and like, and it's just sort of like this interesting lending of like, you know, like it sort of contributes to that sense of LA that something that you would sort of kind of expect, and it's also like a sort of acknowledgement that that these are two Latine characters speaking to each other.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that like Blur Street for Toronto, 24 does occasionally have these moments that are sort of odes to LA, and I think the show is better when it does that. Like, you know, obviously, you know, you have something maybe like Law and Order or something like that, which I think is very embedded in, you know, a false but like compelling version of New York, mm-hmm. right, of this like local place. And I think that sometimes 24, you know, particularly when you're in these office interiors and other places, feels a little anonymous place-wise. But, mm-hmm. you know, for this season, at least once we've kind of gotten outside, it definitely feels like the place this takes, these events happen in, like, matters. And the people there are, like, affected by the place that they're living in. No idea how much this will, you know, come into effect later. I don't know if the show moves closer to that or further away from that. But for this first season, it does feel more tied to LA. Like, you know, we had that whole discussion about traffic and stuff, and mm-hmm. I don't think that ever really comes up again, because you'd be doing it every time someone drove a car.
I feel like it takes actually a good, or I feel like it takes not nearly enough time for Jack to get from that parking garage to the compound.
Yeah.
Just because it's so, like, they clearly cite it's North Valley, and it takes, like, 15 minutes in the show, the episode. We should also mention that we're talking about the hours from 10 a.m. to 12 a.m. To 10 a.m. to 12 p.m.
We're halfway.
We're halfway through day one. And it's sort of, you know, obviously, like, we've talked about, and, like, we'll continue to talk about the sort of the thing that it was only meant for, or it was only originally commissioned for 13 episodes. So we definitely get that feeling where it's, you know, ramping up, and, like, clearly the end of this, the second episode here, is very much the final moments before the full wrapping up of these storylines. But still, like, you know, there's interesting digressions, or, like, interesting paths that this takes. I'm not sure if a lot of them work, but I still think that there's, that it finds its way in, like, from point A to point B to C eventually in an interesting manner.
Yeah, you know, Jack driving around to LA sort of reminds me of, like, the fact that George Costanza in Seinfeld, like, you know, particularly the seasons where he works for the Yankees, like, he's going, like, to, you know, Jerry lives on, like, the Upper West Side, I think, and
something like that.
Like, so he's at Jerry's in the morning, and then he goes to work, and then he comes back to go to the coffee shop in London. It's like, you know, like, I'm only passingly familiar with, like, the move, like, the workings of, you know, New York, and it's like, that's just, like, a totally impractical way to, like, live your daily life. Like, no one can do that. But, you know, like, you sort of have to forget that and make these places, like, a little bit of a fantasy version of those places, you know.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I like about this, these couple episodes, which are, like, sort of a weird, like, I think you're right. It's sort of like a transitory kind of moment in the season. And so there's, like, some things that are working and some things that feel very, like, overdrawn or clunky. But, like, one of the things that's happening is sort of the classic 24 turn from, you know, what you thought was, like, this one conspiracy to, like, a much broader thing. Like, we're finally sort of getting the line drawn between Palmer and Jack, which has kind of been hinted at a little bit, but really here is where it starts to become evident that, like, this is, like, there is a connection. It's about these, plot is about these two men. It's not just that Jack gets drawn into it because he happens to be, you know, the CTU guy, but that these things are related, right? Which is, in retrospect, like, thinking about the show, and again, like, my memory of many of the seasons is quite dim, but I do think this is kind of a thing it repeatedly comes back to, like, revealing these connections and incidences that at first appear sort of randomized and unrelated, but then, like, drawing these unexpected lines or broadening the scope of what we originally understood to be going on.
Right, definitely. And I think it's interesting that it's drawn at certain moments, but then sort of left otherwise, just because there's so much going on for each character, especially Palmer. I actually really like as sort of foolishly as he behaves in the second episode, I like that sort of the setting for him. It's basically just him and Mike in a car, and just them dealing with it for that entire hour.
Yeah.
And it works because they're, you know, in the valley, and they're presumably going around. Like, he was talking at a elementary school before, and now he's talking at he was going to talk about public health, I think, at his next event in an hour. So it gets that sort of tension and knows how to structure his sort of arc. And that's also a Stephen Hopkins episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think I get the Hopkins touch more and more as we go along.
I will say I was impressed with the Guggenheim episode because we get that ridiculous sequence in the limo, which is, like, pretty stupid, but really fun. Like, I think you posted that screenshot of the bulletproof glass. Like, that rocked.
Yeah.
That was so cool. Just, like, Alpha Jack driving this limo around with the sunglasses, and then just, like, using the parking garage to, like, knock Alan out in the back scene as he drove around.
I mean, that whole Jack limo stuff, first with Cafel and then with Alan York, aka Kevin Curl, it's just really, I mean, it's sort of silly, but it's actually the first, I think it's, we finally get sort of real Jack interrogation. It's not quite as, you know, it's not nearly as extreme as it would go later on, but like you do get both like the psychological part, you get the, you know, physical beatings and things like that.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, first off, I found the psychological profile that Nina put together extremely funny.
Yeah.
Like extremely like psychoanalytical.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what is it, like that he, one of his brothers died, and so he's, like, extremely driven or something like that?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
I mean, this entire Cafel stuff, I mean, it both, like I said, I feel like it only feels more frenetic than previous Jack stuff, but then it also becomes, like, the turn that he has, and when he tries to stab Jack with specifically a Microtech Halo knife. But then, like, his entire voice sort of changes in a way that I
that
find...
That ridiculous Serbian accent, yeah, that he whips out, yeah.
I mean, it's fun. I mean, there's a little bit from the findings at CTU. His real name was Borvo Sabrina, and as a teenager, he was recruited by the League of Communist Yugoslavia and sent was trained by the first directorate of the KGB to infiltrate the American financial community.
That rules. I like this guy.
Yeah.
I will say, okay, so this, you know, I'm going to take this and I'm going to take the ball and run with it here a little bit, because we really haven't had like a Jack torture sequence yet.
Yeah.
Which would become a big feature later in the show.
Mm-hmm.
But we do get that just gruesome description of, yeah, like what he might do to this guy. And we also get, like, I mean, you know, I will be the first to admit the show's politics are pretty scrambled.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think it's just, it's a reactionary show in the sense that, you know, as it goes on, it's just, like, constantly bouncing itself off of, like, current events in a weird way. And, you know, but we've also talked about the more, like, you know, kind of centrist brainworms that kind of crawl into it. But, I mean, you do get this kind of, like, classic formulation of, you know, that Jack, even just after this like really disgusting description of this torture he's gonna inflict upon this guy, is like, I'll do everything I can to protect my family, you know.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I think people bat the word around pretty carelessly, but like it does have that kind of like Volkish charge to it, right? This kind of like, mm-hmm, kind of like fascist undertone.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think, like, again, I think the show is mostly, you know, conservative or reactionary in a lot of ways. But it is kind of, like, underpinned with this. We have our kind of, like, you know, we have our Ubermensch, right? in Jack Bauer, who is both, like, a representative of, like, the people and also, you know, the one with the kind of will to do what needs to be done. Like, there's, mm-hmm, there's nothing that can kind of get in the way of this, you know, the protection of, you know, blood and soil, right?
Right.
But, you know, I don't want to overplay that hand too much, but it does, it is funny that, mm-hmm, you know, in the deep lore of the show, this is, you know, a conversation with, like, a communist, right? or someone who at least worked, you know, under and for, like, Soviet communism in its waning days. So that's that moment now, I think, even takes on more of, like, that a very interesting bubbling up of the ideology, like underpinning some of this that actually, you know, in this first season, I really don't think has been a big part of what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, like it's very much just taking the status quo and running with it,
yeah,
but also sort of wanting to, you know, provide that hope in the form of David Palmer. And I think it's very well worth noting that it's sort of, at least in this first scene, sort of leavens what Jack is doing by saying that he doesn't want to hurt him.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, and you feel that, like, sincerely. Like, you,
yeah,
feel that. I mean, there's a, I really like the moment where after Cafel dies, where he's just sort of freaking out, and it's like he's almost,
yeah,
inarticulate when he's trying to revive him. And it, like, Kiefer really plays it well. Actually, these two episodes are a good range showcase for him. But
yeah, when he's, when particularly before the the Jack plot joins up with the Terry and Kim stuff, like, there's some dead spots because he's doing like pretty compelling work, and you know, other players are not given as much to do because we're like just about to come to that point where things converge.
Right, right, definitely. I find it really fascinating how Jack specifically says that the sort of throat towel stomach lining stuff is a Siberian technique that they use when they have very little resources. First off, I thought they were actually gonna, he was just gonna do like waterboarding.
Yeah, I really thought that was
gonna happen. Which would have lent an especially sort of interesting resonant note in a few years, but
also worth noting that he pronounces gulag as gulag, which elicited a big laugh from
me. Yeah, there's also I'm surprised that with looking through the bulletproof glasses as Alnico is shooting, I'm surprised he didn't mention No Time to Die.
yeah, I mean, I definitely thought of that. I think that'll be another screenshot comparison I tweet at some point, probably after this episode is out. Yeah, actually, you know, come to think of it, that whole sequence, right, you have the bulletproof glass and then you have the limo kind of going around in the circle, taking out the bad guy, like different, you know, different from like the Bond gadgetry and stuff.
Yeah.
Which is a big thing I'm noticing, you know, thinking about, you know, Jack Bauer as in a way kind of an American Bond, right?
Yeah, certainly.
That there is, you know, like there is equipment, but there isn't this like gimmick gadgetry. Like, I mean, the closest we probably have come to that so far is that tack knife, which is just kind of velcroed into the like into the crevice of the back seat or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, we get two moments in these two episodes where someone tries to surprise Jack and then he just beats the hell out of them. I mean, Capel, I think he just basically misses, like he just misses his knife stab.
Yeah,
like he just tries and like misses Jack's head by half a foot or something like that. Like you said, Jack's stuff is very momentum driven, and the other stuff, besides I guess the second episode with Palmer, it's very much not. I think that I came to realize that at least for the most part, I have a sinking feeling about a lot of the CTU scenes. As good as Nina and Tony are, I sort of have like a bad feeling about how it's gonna end up playing out for seasons to come.
Yeah, I'm wondering, you know, it's like in episode 11 you have Palmer walking around the Licorice Pizza School.
I looked it up. It's not the same school, but
I assume like that's just like an architectural feature of
it is
of schools from a certain period in LA. But I did
from the valley, valley, yeah,
in the valley in particular, yeah. And like, I think the thing that bugs me about that is like, I feel like that storyline has done the same thing for the last five or six episodes, which is that Palmer is kind of the principled one, but he's only able to be the principled one because everybody around him is willing to kind of like do what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. And he is both, you know, kind of appalled by that, but also every time he tries to be, you know, Mr. Too Damn Principled, it goes awry, right? And so I just feel like we, like all those characters end up having the same conversations until like we do get, like you said, that in episode 12, that much more compelling sequence with him and Mike in the car, which is, I just think Mike kind of serves as a little bit better foil in some ways. Mm-hmm.
Because he's someone that he can trust, so that there's not as much like cloak and dagger stuff. Like it's like more like the principles seem to matter more because they're taking place in a like an actual conversation that's trying to be constructive.
Yeah, he's a pragmatist and also like sort of has this kind of almost a mentor kind of role, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you have, I mean, honestly, at this point, it's in these episodes anyways, I don't even think of the CTU stuff as really like its own. I mean, I guess it's like a D plot because it feels so, I mean, yeah. And that's not really, it's a tough thing to do because I don't know, in later seasons, Chloe is a really compelling anchor at CTU. Mm-hmm. And, you know, is like sort of a weirdo, and you have that.
Yeah, the main thing is that CTU needs more weirdos, which is like why I can't tell if Milo was sent home or is just sort of working on different things. But like, like he's a good sort of CTU weirdo that you need. Like, and it's good to have people like Tony to balance that out. But it's still like you need that sort of tension and energy there. And right now it's just like all business officiousness sort of things. I do like that we finally get Tony and Nina holding hands at the chapter. Like it was like finally there's that a sort of like another moment of, you know, even partial intimacy. But yeah, it's just like there's sort of the thing where I like how you say it's sort of almost not its own plot, where it's really just backing up Jack, because that is really the role that Nina has sort of assumed, which is kind of surprises me, but especially because how sincerely it's taking it. Obviously they didn't write her as a Moya, but it's still like it's written very sincerely in a way that sort of tampers with, I guess, the ambiguity elsewhere.
And I guess that's one of the problems, is that, you know, the way the show was written is, you know, more like a TV show than a movie, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Which is that if you condense this into, you know, a 2-hour film, like the Nina stuff is going to have a momentum. Like right now they don't know what to do with her, which is maybe one of the on the positive side, this very fact that this plot is kind of treading water might be the thing that sort of eventually got the writers to think, oh, well, this would be pretty compelling if this person was, you know, the actual mole that we've been talking about. Because the talk of the mole, like I think maybe Ira or his boss mentioned something about their other mole at CTU at some point, but it's really not like everybody at CTU or related to CTU thinks like they got him, the mole's done, right? So all we're left with is kind of like, oh, okay, there's another hard ass boss, and you know, she's gonna do things by the book, and she's gonna try and nail Nina and Tony. It's just sort of, I feel like we'll be coming out of that soon.
I think I feel like Ira still doesn't realize that Jamie is dead. Like he's just like waiting for her to.
Oh, that's true. I suppose he doesn't really know, does he? Yeah.
Like it would have been kind of fun if there was like where, like, you know, or Tony had to sort of man the PDA and sort of try to keep him preoccupied while they were still trying to help Jack, like something like that, like another sort of variety, like another thing to sort of, you know, change up things. I mean, you know, there's definitely a point where it can get too, you know, convoluted or too I feel like there is definitely that dead space.
I think a compelling thing would be to have Nina doing that, because you would get this really interesting thing where the viewer is, of course, reading this all as as her, trying to throw him off. But in actuality, what they're seeing is like a plot revelation that won't transpire for like many more episodes.
That's true. Yeah.
But instead, because that hasn't been decided on yet. Yeah. It just feels like a little stale, these two episodes.
Right.
But that might pick up. And I don't know about future seasons. I hadn't really thought of that. I can't remember many exciting sequences happening in CTU, but that could also just be my own memory. I mean, I'm having watched half of this season now, I'm sort of in my brain, I've half reconstructed kind of the closing act of this season.
Right.
And so I think that a lot of that does take place in CTU.
Yeah, that's true. I do wonder how much it'll change when we have other CTU field agents with Jack a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Because that's something which I actually didn't remember. Like, he is really a lone wolf in a way that obviously other seasons will echo, but
yeah,
I think that it's especially prevalent here. Like, it's the only thing, like, to the exclusion of all else. Like, he is going to take on 20 guys in a compound but he is dual wielding, so
yeah, he did. We gotta talk about dual wields. Yeah, we'll have to talk about Halo at some point.
Yes. Another accidental 9/11 text.
Yeah, Halo 1 vibes for sure.
There's no dual wielding in Halo 1 though.
Yeah, but you get that Magnum pistol, you know.
That's true.
Yeah, I think that it's just sort of like a weird time in the show. You can definitely tell that there's this transition going on. And, you know, this is obviously speculation, but like you mentioned, I think some of that probably comes from the fact that, you know, it didn't have a full season order at first. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, how funny would it be if this was like a one season wonder and they had to wrap it up in episode 13 and like, yeah, then the show was over. You know, they go out on a limb at first by just calling it 24.
Yeah, that's, you know? Yeah. What would the world be like if this was another Firefly?
Well, first of all, I would rather have Stephen Hopkins in charge of our culture for the last, you know, 15 years than Joss Whedon. I think we'd be living in a better society.
Yeah, I mean, I like some of his work, but you know, there's also been like, that's a very specific thing that, like, to a specific person with a specific, I guess, personality or something like that, or temperament, yeah. Or voice. The Stephen Hopkins touch would definitely be more malleable in a certain way. I mean, like, we see that to a certain extent here. I mean, yeah. Hopefully we'll see that with Joel Surnow, but yeah, I think, yeah, there's definitely I don't know if it would be an enormous change, but there's definitely a possibility that, like, what if I'm trying to imagine a MCU where the presiding spirit was Stephen Hopkins.
Oh, man. Well, first of all, you know, I mean, I think that one of the reasons Stephen Hopkins is so far noticeably, like, the kind of auteur, if you will, of this show is that I think the show is very obviously kind of indebted to, like, the Bazanian tendency, right? Okay, we have this real-time construct, we have, you know, this is not they're not flights of fancy going on here, you know, there is a certain there is a certain kind of perspective, mm-hmm. That I think, you know, is deep time backwards. It comes from Bazan, right? But Hopkins is, through his innovation, is a purveyor of Eisensteinian dialectical montage. So he's bringing together, you know, the two tendencies that were, you know, embattled in early 20th century cinema, and he's created a synthesis. And
he's creating a synthesis of thesis. Antithesis and antithesis. So it's like, yeah, exactly. this hydra of
yeah, synthesis. It is monstrous, but it is compelling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for one thing, if the presiding spirit of, you know, blockbuster filmmaking was Stephen Hopkins, I think, like, we would have better looking blockbuster films. I think that you know, something that I would like to watch as part of this podcast at some point is Ang Lee's Hulk.
Oh,
because yeah, it has those, like, that comic book panel thing going on,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
which comes after 24, although shortly after. So I don't know that that Lee was influenced by this at all. Mm-hmm. And you know, the comic book paneling suggests itself in the making of a comic book film. It's kind of astonishing that he was really the first one to do it.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, you know, I don't want to spend a bunch of time talking about the MCU. Because it just does nothing for me. I can't even bring myself to, like, feel animus toward it, other than, like, you know, it is kind of this globe-conquering behemoth of culture. Right. But, like, there's no there to me. Like, there's nothing to... There are no ideas or images or themes that I think are really worth, like, wrestling with at all. Mm-hmm. And I think that at the very least, Hopkins is doing something visually that, like, is missing from a lot of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, especially in the scenes of Jack sneaking around the compound. Like, there are these, like, really... There's, like, this shot that pans from the trucks or the vans to Jack just running in the background.
So, yeah.
Like, there's a certain... like, sense for movement. I mean, it doesn't quite extend to knowing exactly where we are on the compounds.
Yeah.
Because, you know, his style is predominantly pretty close up when he's not, you know, panning and,
yeah,
you know, doing like more forthrightly action scenes, but there's still definitely something there. Also, speaking of early 20th century cinema, from the moment that Terry and Kim got placed into the barn, or I guess it's a barn or some sort of storage, like way back.
I think they called it the guest house.
Oh yeah, the guest
house. But I don't know if that's like Ira's little sick joke.
but especially once I remembered Terry shooting Eli, there's like, it reminded me of the end of Les Vampires.
Oh yeah. Yeah. On the other end, I think what's lacking from the Terry Kim stuff is the tension of Panic Room.
Oh yeah, that's a good point.
To go to the complete opposite end of where you were at.
But yeah, I mean, obviously, like, to go back to the extremely ill-advised stuff that happened in a few episodes back with Terry. Like, there's a certain, I mean, I kind of like that it's not presented strictly as like a rape revenge sort of thing. Like, yeah. I'm glad that it's not like really brought up in that way. I do feel like that the undercurrents of that are definitely there. I like that the focus is really on Kim and her lack of remorse or lack of regret about his death. As funny as the sight of him just being put on a table under a tub is.
What I wonder is, how on earth did this coupling of these two just stone cold, like, action oriented people result in Kim, who is just unable, unwilling to really like do anything. Right, I mean, who has just been kind of taken along throughout this mm-hmm. plot, like exercised mm-hmm. very little agency, and you know, in that moment, like, yeah, I do think like that it is playing on the revenge aspect, but also like Terry is like thinking correctly, which is that they're expecting to hear two shots, and if they hear yeah. two shots, you know, it's, no one's yeah, going to think stated, anything about it.
It's stated a little bit flatly for my liking, but you know, yeah, I understand. Like it's like the Nina Flak jacket scene, like where you have yeah. to give a little bit for the audience, it works ultimately,
yeah, which is maybe, you know, I mean, maybe like one of the things about Kim is that she's a little bit of an audience cipher, like we don't yeah. really mm-hmm. we don't have a clear stand-in for the audience in the show, but like right. I mean, I think that like she knows about what we know about what's going on at this point. Now that's starting to change because like the viewers are starting to get more insight into like the unraveling plot, but right. and particularly for the early part of the season, it's like we're kind of carried along in this too, sort of mm-hmm. blindly. Yeah, but I'm glad that we get to the point where they're out of the compound, and you know, yeah. I have no idea what the hell the show is going to do with them for the next ten episodes. You know, eventually, I know in the finale, like they become important again, but I have no idea what. I mean,
yeah, I mean, like I
have no clue.
Yeah, it's a, you know, there's a number of things that I've not looked up purposefully. One of them being exactly where David Palmer's from, but also that's one of the things I just really want to discover for as the show goes on, like if they actually say where he's from. But also like just what they're gonna do with Terry and Kim, because you know they're still at the point where if you're a main cast member, you're in literally every single episode. So it's yeah. sort of, you know, just not knowing where it's going to go. I do like that Kim is extremely tired at this point. Like, she's napping, like, every other episode.
Oh, yeah. Like, one whole scene is just her, like, falling asleep and Terry trying to wake her up.
It has the exact same, like, temperament as, like, a parent trying to wake their kid for school. Like, it has yeah. that exact same register, which is
yeah
kind of amusing. It doesn't quite work. But also, like, yeah. she gets up immediately once Rick enters the room.
Yeah, I think, I will say, I think what that plot strand suffers the most from is that it really cannot incorporate even the, you know, sparsely used humor that other strands do.
Yeah,
because there's just, like, the show kind of has to take that so seriously, because that is like their captivity is the thing driving Jack, really.
Right, right.
So it's never, you know, we get a little bit, I mean, and maybe this is naive, but I do think that just like that sequence of Jack knocking Alan out in the limo, like the music cue, all of that, like, I think it's like,
there's a weird rock thing.
Yeah, I don't think it's meant to be like, it's not like camp or, like ironic, but I do think it's meant to be like fun in the way that action is fun.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it's like having a good time with the thing that it's doing.
Yeah, you know? Just like this guy being awesome.
Yeah, and even like, and even a little bit like Palmer's kind of walk and talking, and then, you know, just like being able to hand people off, or like, he signs that fucking basketball.
He signs it in the cafeteria.
Yeah. I was just like, what? But yeah, like even some of that stuff, and you know, I don't know, I feel like it's a little bit intentional to be like, yeah, okay, politician guy. Even this guy, who they're very much framing as like a good guy that actually cares about these people, is like, you know, he's got more important things to do than hear from the rubes what they think.
Or like you get like Carl, like just sitting in this smoky dark office, I guess, he's talking, like, it's sort of like, you
what
know,
is
like,
with
it's
the lighting in that scene. There's like something like flashing on him, or like,
oh, I don't know,
reflecting.
Maybe I don't quite remember that, but like it's just like, you know, it's at certain points it allows itself to lean into these, you know, these sort of more ridiculous elements in a way that it can't really do with Terry and Kim. Like there's that the brief interaction between Kevin and Al Leong, where he's like, I got in a fight with her wife or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, yeah, even the bad guys can joke around, but
yeah, exactly.
And even Rick, you know, gets to kind of go around and like play the doofus.
Yeah. We finally get some. I strongly suspect that we'll be getting very few Ira moments left. We have very few Ira moments left, but we get some good ones in these two episodes also. Like
yeah,
we get a sort of like we're after Rick asks if he should load the van first before checking on Eli. He's like, oh yeah, sure. <He's like this>. And then like when he's talking with Rick while he's in the van, and he's like, you first get his face reflected in the window, and then you get him like angrily telling him to unlock the door.
Yeah. It's there's like some good stuff going on there, but then, you know, understandably the Terry and Kim stuff just does not. It's just played so straight and serious, which again is like, it probably has to be that way, but we spend so much time just in that room, which is very boring to look at. Not a lot going on, you know, spatially. So yeah, I'm glad that they've you know, broken out.
And the scenes, I mean, first off, Jack's reunion with them is extremely good. And also, like, you get that sort of requisite moments of tenderness with them, like, as they're waiting for Rick to come back. But, like, it also, you know, it also plays. Like, there's a, you know, like, an earnestness to it that...
Oh, for sure.
Like it's an earnestness, but... And, like, the other parts with Terry and Kim have been earnest, but also, you know, like, it's another kind of earnest. Like there's another element in there that, like, livens it up a little bit. I do like that... I really want to go back and to the first scene and see if Kim actually has Mayton too. Somehow they should have gotten Elisha Cuthbert in the Queen's Gambit. Somehow.
That would have been great. Yeah.
Also, speaking of like weirdly specific references, why Waco? Why did Jack cite
Waco? Oh, yeah. I did make note of that. Yeah, I mean, so in the, I think it was in the IMDb trivia had a big long entry about this. Mm-hmm. And the entry was basically like explaining what Waco was. you know, I don't know who moderates the IMDb trivia section, but I don't think that's trivia. But I mean, I think the idea is like in the American brain, you know, pre 9/11, I think you have like two preceding events that feel pretty big, which are like the Oklahoma bombing and Waco, right?
Yeah.
That would be like in the realm of like the 24 verse, okay? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think the idea is like, yeah, why there needs to be some kind of logic.
Yeah,
even
like
even a rickety one for Jack going in, because I think that like the show really does try to refrain from making Jack stupid. Like Jack's cunning.
Yeah, Jack's
and he's quick on his feet.
Yeah, he's a hothead, but he can back it up. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, so like I think this is maybe the most ridiculous thing he's done, which is that you have this compound with a bunch of armed people. Like he's not like, you know, he's not superpowered. Like that's that's what makes him compelling, is that he's just he really is meant to be a guy, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I mean, making a whole big deal about the Waco thing to me was just like, okay, you have this quote unquote compound. You know, it's sort of been called that and referenced as that. And yeah, so like what is the end game if, you know, 100 CTU agents and the FBI and the police and whoever show up? Like it's a standoff. Yeah. And it's a standoff with hostages. And yeah, so I mean, I think to some degree it's like, it's a quick shorthand to like immediately get the audience to understand what Jack's line of thinking is, even if it just seems like a totally ridiculous line, you know? Yeah, I mean, that's sort of what I thought of it. But it does arrive sort of awkwardly.
Yeah.
In that, you know, it's one of the few times we get some kind of reference to a real world event like that.
Right. Yeah, there's a... Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Like, it's like maybe more because it breaks out of the... I mean, it's not quite a diegesis of the show, but like it sort of more invokes something like you can actually... That was... You know, obviously I wasn't cognizant of it.
Yeah.
But I feel like, you know, when for people who were paying attention to things back then, like, still would have gotten... I looked it up, it was in 1993, so 8 years on. I feel like, yeah, there's... It was still fairly fresh. I guess the thing that was sort of weird was because it's, so like, because, you know, it was the Koresh's Ranch Davidians, like, we're just, like, in a much different... It's secluded, but it was a much different, you know, thing.
Like
it,
there's like no cult aspect here.
Yeah,
there's
exactly.
No,
like,
yeah.
Like they're, you know, they're. I feel like I mean, obviously, terrorism was, not as at the forefront of people's minds quite at that moment, pre 9/11. But you know, it was just this sort of odd mixing of metaphors, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I mean, if I could spin out here for just a moment, like I think that there is a certain, current. That definitely went on the wane post 9/11, but I think there was on the right in particular a strong feeling that, you know, Waco was a huge overstep, and a huge like, particularly if you think about, you know, the sort of like the kind of default accidental libertarianism a lot of people have about things, right? Which is like not necessarily to offer some kind of alternative for how those things could have gone or to offer like a broader critique, but just to sort of be like, this is an example of, you know, brute state power. And yeah, maybe these people were weirdos and whatever. But yeah, so I think that in some ways, you know, it's a little bit like, well, we want to have our kind of, you know, kind of right-wing hero here, our kind of reactionary figure. But at the same time, he's also like a representative of the state, right? So like, what do you do in a situation like this? He's both able to be kind of like the lone man, to have that, you know, if you will, cowboy mentality, right? Again, 24 as Western, right? Like he's not rounding up a posse, and he's not calling the cops. Like he is the authority. He is the will in this situation. And so I think there is like a convoluted route through which you could read this in sort of like a political way, but I also think that it's just kind of like, well, if you're in a writer's room and you need an excuse not to do the thing that probably is most logical in the situation, you know, or that most people would think of like, okay, now we have a big face off at the compound, right? That being said, I think that a sequence like that could have been really interesting.
Oh yeah.
And really switched up the energy of the show, right? Which is that, well, what happens then if you have like a 2 to 3 episode standoff? Like,
oh,
that
yeah,
could be
yeah.
really interesting. Mm-hmm. And instead we get an exciting and cool action sequence, but right. one that is definitely more like, okay, let's get it. We got to get in and get out in the next 45 minutes. You know?
Yeah. That's a, I mean, I, you know, there's definitely the possibility that they would do some sort of standoff later on. You know, it definitely requires a certain amount of resources, but I yeah. feel like there's going to be, you know, at least, you know, something
yeah.
happening next episode. I can't quite remember it yet. But yeah, that's sort of, I just thought of the when Jack is just whacking the wet towel on the hood of the car. Like, there's some, like, I do really like how that Kafel stuff mutates, even
yeah,
though like
yeah.
I still think the setup is extraordinarily shaky, and sort of like it at first, like, it just doesn't feel right that this sort of kind of doughy finance guy is like would quite act this way, obviously, like, once it changes, but still, like, there's I like how he says, like, you're a good liar, but I seem better. that sort of, again, like, the when it uses languages differently, I kind of wish that we had gotten like a Jack speaking a little bit of Serbian also, but
yeah,
no such dice.
Yeah,
Jack has to know Serbian, right? Because he was in Kosovo and Belgrade.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I sort of began looking. I didn't want to look too much ahead, but I did begin looking at, like, okay, what is Operation Nightfall, right? Because I don't know how much of that gets totally elucidated, right? But one of the problems at this point in the show is that Jack Bauer's past seems to be just, like, all over the place, right?
Sure.
Which is that, you know, this, not to, like, spoil things, but the operation is like a Delta Force operation.
Oh.
At least this is what the 24 wiki was telling me, which sort of, like, to me confuses me as to why Jack Bauer is involved in this, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his past is a little bit all over the place. And we see this again in the sequence, like, after Kafel dies, which Jack kind of has this moment, which I think we'll see fewer of in circumstances like this going forward, where it does feel like he's kind of overwhelmed, both because he's kind of let his temper get the best of himself and maybe foiled a chance to find his family.
Right.
And also, like, you know, the killing that he's doing does seem to begin to have an effect on him, and probably the lack of sleep as well. and eating, he still hasn't eaten anything.
Definitely no opportunities in these two episodes.
Yeah. But I don't know.
Actually, maybe there should have been like a mini bar in that limo that you could have snacked on. Maybe into that off screen.
Yeah. All of it takes place off screen.
Yeah, it doesn't count for our calculus though.
Yeah, I think that the show is still on this kind of like slightly. You know, I think that kind of the downfall and magic of 24 is that you get these really fantastic sequences that are strung together by just the ricketiest bridges. And it's like, yeah, we had to go through the kind of convoluted and frankly sort of stupid way that he gets in contact with Kafel in order to get like this good string of scenes that like work well and have a lot of propulsion and like have some cool action and plot revelation. Like when everything's humming along, you kind of forget that like getting there was a rough ride, right? And I think that's kind of like how the Terry and Kim stuff is a little bit too, which is that you have to end up bringing these people together, and like sometimes you just have to like make it happen.
Yeah, I feel the same way about like the scene where Jack is just sort of calls Alberta, and he just lays it out so casually. Like it's really, I mean, I think that, you know, like there's a certain thing where the actress has to play the role, and it's sort of, you know, it's just very overbearing in a way that just doesn't really work with the tenor of the other performances.
Mm-hmm.
But like that scene where she talks with Jack, and there's this sort of mutual understanding or mutual hostility that becomes its own form of understanding is something that I liked. That he just sends the coordinates on his Palm Pilot.
Yeah, I like one thing, you know, and I think I'm digging for complexity here a little bit, but one thing I found interesting about the way that that resolves itself is that, you know, she does know that they're all lying. Yeah. She suspects very strongly.
Right.
But because of the way things are developing, she simply has to accept the story as it's been told, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because now, of course, there's no pressure that she can exert on these people to confess what they've actually been doing.
Right.
So I think that's a little bit interesting. I really, at the end of this episode, was really the first time in the show so far where I was like, I really have no idea what's going to happen until like the last 2 hours. Like, I have no idea what's going to go on.
Yeah, same.
In the next 10 episodes. Because I know it's not just like everybody hanging around until, I'm interested to see. I feel like there's at least one more big development that will take place before all of the final stuff comes to a head.
Yeah.
I just honestly cannot remember.
Yeah, I honestly thought that that Jack wouldn't break them out of the compound until episode 13. So like I was a bit surprised that it sort of so quickly went into this action.
Well, it's still kind of ongoing. Like,
yeah, no, it's ongoing,
on the run. Yeah.
But I thought they would maybe be trapped and then rescued by CT, or he would break out again or something like that.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
But yeah, back to the sort of the Palmer plot. As good as the episode 12 stuff is, I do feel like it's another 24 cheat when Farrakhan just gets taken out by a office fire.
An extraordinarily stupid way to kill someone.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's just so blunt the way it happens.
It happens in like 5 minutes, it feels like.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd have to go back and watch again, but I feel like not that much time elapses between when he gets off the phone with them and when they arrive and, you know, there's a fire.
Yeah, let's see. So he calls around 11:22, and then they roll up at 11:42. So like, were the guys in the building? I feel like it takes a little bit of time to, you know, set a fire, then get out. You know,
like, you have to make sure the guy's dead, and that however you killed him, it's covered up by the fire, right?
And that the records are gone.
Yeah,
I guess it's good that it probably destroyed the answering machine also, so like that wouldn't come back on Palmer. But also, like, there's this sort of thing like where it, you know, exculpates him in a certain way, not in terms of like the death, but like in terms of him contacting and leaving a vaguely or a vague message on his answering machine.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that sequence is interesting because it does kind of display his like the naive nature of the way he looks at you know, what he does and like the world that he's in, right? Which is that Carl sort of has a very clear-eyed, if cynical, perspective, which is why I think Mike is so interesting, because he's kind of this balance between of, you know, he's not a cynic, but he is very much a pragmatist, and also like he can see something Palmer can't, which is like, you're calling this guy and telling him that there's a threat on his life. Like, yeah, that's going to come off as a threat from you. Like, do you not understand that you're probably not helping him or you in this situation?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I think that the Palmer stuff will probably be switching gears more toward his relationship to the terror plotting, which I think is good, because I think now kind of definitively this thing with his son is kind of a dead end now. Like, it feels like, what else can you really do?
Yeah.
With this?
They've already gotten to the point where it's basically saying like the deep state is trying to control you.
Yeah.
Or like has been controlling you. Like, it's sort of, unless they're going to do like 12 episodes of him sort of unraveling the deep state. There's a possibility that that could happen, but
I think more of that stuff comes into play when he's president, right?
I mean, I assume it's always a thing that happens.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Well, and it's interesting too, because again, reading a little bit ahead and read about Operation Nightfall, that is kind of the origin of the antagonism between like CTU and the CIA, for instance. Like,
oh, okay.
within the world of the show, which is that, you know, CTU is going in, and I may be reversing this, so the real heads out there can fact check me, but if I remember correctly, like, CTU is going in to kill a certain person, and the CIA is going in to get him out and make sure he survives, right? Because they have some purpose for him, okay? So this is so interesting, because the CTU is, like, the good, quote-unquote, good deep state, and the CIA is not, which is fascinating, and it sort of, it almost feels like, you know, because it's in the former Yugoslavia, and it does feel like Operation Nightfall has shades of, like, you know, the sunsetting of, like, Gladio type operations in Europe, like stay behind networks and stuff like that. Obviously the show it's not gonna, you know, elaborate on that stuff too much, but it is interesting to think about, you know, at this point very early in the show, how it's not a post 9/11 show yet. It's a post Soviet show.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, yeah. Like, the sort of, is this still taking place in the end of history is the question.
Yeah.
Or is 24 perpetually in the end of history?
That's a great question.
Yeah, I guess we'll see as it develops. I feel like at a certain point it re-enters the timeline, but yeah. Actually, yeah, I hadn't thought of it in quite those terms, but okay.
Yeah.
That's definitely something to keep in mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that future seasons will have to keep returning to that question. Because yeah, right now I think it is a show about, well, what do you, like, what's actually dangerous now? And it's, like, these personal, it's not some kind of impersonal force out there. It's not an invading army. It's not, you know, the specter of communism. Although, like, that still haunts all these things, right? But it's, like, what hurts you? Oh, it's people who have a vendetta against you.
Right.
And, like, that's it. And you have, like, there isn't even so much, like, protect your country stuff in this. Like, it's really not hitting that kind of stuff at all. It's really about Jack just trying to protect his family.
And Palmer trying to work out the best thing with his family too.
And it's the exact, and Jamie as well, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's what is also motivating all of these people,
like even Tony with Nina.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I do wonder if, like, the second half of the season will majorly, well, I guess probably not, since, you know, at least for the last few episodes, Taryn can become very important again. But yeah. We'll have to keep that in mind. A few more notes. It was weird watching this second episode in particular, because I just seen Lincoln yesterday, or we watched Lincoln. And the dynamic between Mike and Palmer, like, reminds me of the dynamic that Lincoln has with David Strathairn as Secretary Seward, like this sort of like this pragmatism, like this sort of confiding, and, you know, like trying to negotiate that dynamic, I think is really fun. And, like, going back to the sort of transitional point that you made, like, I find it kind of weird that for, even though they're clearly trying to move towards Andre Drazen as the next antagonist, it's sort of weird, like, how he disappears, like, he's just there for a few scenes in episode 11, then immediately disappears for all of episode 12.
Yeah, that's a great point. I was just thinking about that while we were talking about it. Do we see him leave the compound? I feel like we see him like he's arriving at the compound, and that's when he talks to Ira and it's like, we've got another plan and you're not part of it, right? You have X amount of time to take care of this. Yeah, so is he just, like, chilling in, like, Ira's lair during this time? What is he?
Yeah,
it is interesting the way that the real-time constraint both is the source of the show's, like, greatest strength, and also often its weakest moments are generated by that
constraint. Where they have to focus on Ira because he's the one that poses the most imminent threat to Jack in episode 12. So they exclude the thing that they're trying to build up to in a weird way.
I took very few notes on the Hopkins episode. one thing I do want to mention is that despite the kind of crescendo sequence, it's a very slow burn episode.
Yeah.
Which at first I was not as into, only because we just had, like, some ridiculous sequences in episode 11, but I think ultimately works and builds up as, like, it feels like a mid-season finale in a lot of ways, which is, I think, why Hopkins is directing it. And, you know, I think in this first season, they're dropping him in at, like, the key moments in the show. I think it's Koval that that asked Jack, what kind of man are you? Which I think is a really penetrating question.
Yeah, and he also, like, he also says, like, why do you have a bulletproof limo? It's like, to protect myself from guys like you.
Yes, yeah. And then... I do love that Mike tells Palmer, I think you're paranoid.
Yeah.
I hope this show becomes more paranoid as it goes on.
Oh, yeah. I hope so, too.
And I think it will.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I think that the way season one, you know, in my mind anyways, feels like, you know, it feels like a pilot season in that the arc is very self-contained. It has a startling but conclusive resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And it also sets the table for everything else that comes after, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think we are getting a little bit of, you know, shady backroom political deals and covert operations and stuff. And, like, some of that stuff is coming up in this season and will come up more as we go along. But I think... you know, once we get into, you know, the Palmer presidency and later presidencies, I think we get a lot more palace intrigue, a lot more deep state stuff. You know, like right now, it's interesting how much the show is still kind of outside the main vectors of, like, power.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these are all, like, all of our main people are not the people big in charge, which is an interesting thing that I had sort of forgotten about the early season. So, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think continued paranoia will make the show better. And I think, of course, the revelation of Nina is one of the ways that that really gets kicked into high gear. So,
yeah, definitely. One thing I do want to mention, I just remember in the file that we had, like, there were two shots where it briefly switched to 4-3. Did you see that?
I did. Because which episode was that?
That was during the shootout.
Yeah,
like there's one like where Ira fires like shoots out the tire, and then there was another one where Terry and Kim were just running away, and both were in 4-3. I don't know if that was something like the transfer or something like that, but or like they wanted to do a split screen, but they just didn't get around to it.
Yeah, I think I even rewatched that on you know, Roku TV, where 24 is currently streaming. I don't think it did that, but there were a couple, every once in a while they do a thing where they don't do a split screen, but the window is just like smaller. Like in the opening credits of one of these episodes, they did that.
Yeah.
And at first I was like, wait, something wrong? Cause there like wasn't another image up there, but then it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like your beginning episode, like checking in with everybody, that kind of thing. Yeah. So yeah. I'm not sure if that would be a transfer issue or it could, I mean, frankly, if you know, if someone, if this has been ripped from, you know, the DVDs or whatever, or a higher def file, like it might just be something that's like native to that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, because I didn't notice it when I streamed it.
Mm-hmm. But something that you should stream is Blur Street.
Out now.
Out now. We'll our first bonus episode will be our track by track review of Blur Street.
Yes.
But please. Please tune in for the not mid-season finale, but I kind of like that we're doing the, you know, the original possible finale and the next episode together. Like, I like that'll provide some interesting contrasts.
Yeah, I think it's a key moment.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah,
and please join us then.
Yeah.